as we return to the broadcasting world of 1936 and an era when radio was the friend in the corner. Daphne Oxenford plays the voice of the BBC Handbook.
Darcy, Morgal, hame kinjak kan bi atas palafasin jingreiz.
The unknown writer of the soul-stirring poem in which the lines from the lone sheeling in the misty island, mountains divide us and a world waste of seas, did not foresee that the separation and loneliness of country life in the Highlands would be reduced by the aid of almost magical modern science. From today, a further step has been taken to effectively diminish that solitude. By the enterprise of the British Broadcasting Corporation from all over the earth, voices can speak to us, artists can sing, and musicians distill sweet music in our ears.
This is the national program. Ladies and gentlemen, music hall.
Hello, people, everybody happy? Oh, that's the idea. Poor ginger, really nice and happy. Oh, that's the idea.
German troops made a formal entry into the demilitarized zone on the left bank of the Rhine. Berlin states that no reoccupation in force is intended and that only small detachments have marched in as a symbol that the last shackle of the Treaty of Versailles has been broken.
A so-called German dog. You know the kind of a dog. A dachshund, or the long kind of dog. They sold him as a yard dog, but they underestimate. How I gossip? No. And now for another lively tune while we are still so full of the beans. Landsleute, a country dance from Bavaria. Turn around the map, boys.
Programs for Sunday, the national program. 9:30 a.m. religious service. 10:15 a.m. closed on. 11 a.m. religious service in Welsh. 12:17 closed on. 2:15 gramophone recital of uplifting works. 4:30 religious service. 5 p.m. the Bishop of Melanesia speaks on spreading the gospel in the South Seas. 5:30 Bible story for children. 8 p.m. short service from studio. 8:30 the week's good cause. 8:45 the Torquay Municipal Orchestra. 10:30 epilogue. Keeping the body in temperance, soberness, and chastity.
This is the children's hour from the north. Hello, children. Hello, children.
Hello, children.
Hello, children.
Now for the country. Here's Gypsy Petulengro. Each week he travels to some part of this country and, as only a gypsy can, observes and remembers for you what's going on in the world in which he lives. Until he returns to the studio every Wednesday night, we haven't the least idea where he's been. But here he is, Gypsy Petulengro.
Kushti Rama Saraj, the Kushti Bak. Well, since I spoke to you last Wednesday, I've had a busy time. Last Thursday, I had to perform a Ramani wedding ceremony under starlit skies that night. There was a beautiful setting for it in a well-wooded dell. Giant oaks laden with nut-brown acorns and hazelnut bushes well-laden with nuts. And didn't the chais and chels, that's the boys and the girls, have a real time? Big heaps of wood was gathered for the big yog, the fire, that was to be burning. Mushrooms had to be gathered for the stew of rabbits and hochi-wichi, that's the hedgehog, which formed the menu, the wedding feast. Now, on Saturday, I didn't travel very far, as everyone else of the party had drifted away, and it fell on me to clean up the camp. I was sitting by the fireside when a handsome-looking young policeman called for me, and he said to me, "You gypsies used to cause me many sleepless nights, but we've got something worse than you to contend with now. It's the town folks who come out here with high-powered motor cars and bring guns with them. They pop off a few pheasants as they're roosting in the trees, then they're off in the big cars like wind."
A talk on speed by Sir Malcolm Campbell, who has perhaps more right than any other man to talk on this subject. I am so often asked to describe my experiences when...
A talk on cricket by Commander C.B. Fry, who needs no further introduction.
There is a small, round, red moving object which we invite ourselves to hit accurately with a broad and not unhandy club.
During 1936, the talks department excels itself, providing the national and regional programs with a cornucopia of subjects. The means test, French fashion, the future of the colonies, a conquest of the air, Plato and democracy, the printing industry, bedbugs, plant diseases, color in flowers, Victorian politicians, limestone formation, cosmic rays, and cool storage.
Once again, we stop the mighty roar of London's traffic, and from the great crowds, we bring to you some of the interesting people who've come by land, sea, and air to be in town tonight.
Tonight, we're taking you to the headquarters of the London Fire Brigade. Give you an idea of the work that goes on there, not only at night, but throughout the 24 hours.
We're doing something tonight which we really should be heavily punished. And that is, we're going to sound a false alarm. About a quarter of a mile away on the Albert Embankment, we've got an observer who's going to pull the alarm there. And then, the moment he's pulled it, we'll come back here and you'll hear what the effect of that alarm really is in the station here.
There isn't much traffic about and there aren't many people. And standing beside this fire alarm, I've got rather a furtive sort of feeling. Particularly as I can see two policemen on the other side of the road watching me rather carefully. Now, beside me, this alarm, you know what it looks like. You've seen them all over the place. A little house-shaped box on top of a red post, and the instructions on it are fairly explicit. It says, brake alarm. A tram just going by, a 14 tram going down the embankment to Westminster. It says, brake glass, full handle, and wait here.
There the bell, and there they go. Down to the appliance room.
They're spitting down the poles here. They're all running by. There go the engine. The engine started up. The door's cracked open. And there goes the first one. Still coming down the pole, putting on the hats and the boots as they go. And away goes the first engine out. And so back to the embankment.
I can see the lights turned red. I can see the first engine just turned out. And here they come. Here comes the second. The three of them. Great strong headlights flashing out. A bus just gone by, drawing to one side, the engines come, and here they come, here are the bells. And on the other side of the road now, there's a bus coming in, the 77 bus, they're crossing now, and here is the first engine drawing up beside the fire alarm. And the time taken for that was 1 minute and 9 seconds. Pretty quick work. Well, now all the firemen dismount with their helmets and their leggings on, and the station officer comes forward and he rings through and notifies the station that it's a false alarm. Well, that was quick work, officer. 1 minute, 9 seconds, you took.
Yes, well, it's good to know that it isn't an actual fire. And we, of course, must now return to our station immediately.
I'm sorry that we've had to dirty up your engines coming out on such a filthy night as this.
Well, of course, we don't mind. It's all of our day's work.
Once upon a time, our home was happy, so we thought. And father was the decent soul, in fact, he was a sport. Till he got on the wireless, everything was quite alright. Until the BBC put him into In Town Tonight. His father did a broadcast at the BBC when they gave In Town Tonight. He puts in all his H's when he speaks, it sounds so clear. He's always sending SOS's to the pub for beer. He's always hated work and any job he shirks. But now he's grown as useless as can be. When he turns out the light, he says we've closed down for tonight. Since he broadcast at the BBC. He says the summons is he gets our letters from his fans. He has a red lamp burning when he goes to wash his hands. He's always hated work and any job he shirks. But now he's grown as useless as can be. He lifts and rolls his eyes cause he wants to tell he lies. Since he broke out at the TV.
The Second News, copyright by Reuters Press Association, Exchange Telegraph and Central News.
Fighting in the university city of Madrid appears to have gone on more or less all night. Fighting has also been resumed west of Madrid in the Casa de Campo and directly south of Madrid. In the south, the insurgent success is considerable, as they are now...
News. During the past year, much attention has been given to including among topical talks what are known as actuality items, that is, the broadcasting of events as they are actually happening. Among outstanding incidents in this actuality reporting may be mentioned the broadcast from the banks of the Mississippi at Memphis whilst the floods were at their height. A report from inside a gas-filled chamber by an observer who had a microphone inside his gas mask, and a report of the Crystal Palace fire by an observer who was actually in the blazing building with the firemen.
It's a pretty clear sky, and a moment ago there was almost a full moon looking straight at me across this blaze of smoke and ruins. There's a very strong wind. I'm up on the top of a house here. There's somebody got an umbrella behind me trying to shield the microphone, and I don't quite know how much of the wind on the microphone you may be getting, but I hope you can hear what I'm saying. There goes one of the bells. I don't know what that means. By the North Tower there, there's the building just between me and the South Tower. It's beginning to blaze up, and I can see smoke coming through all the tiles on the roof. What? They tell me there's something wrong about my position by the microphone. I'm trying to find out. There's a dickens of a lot of wind on the microphone, but I don't quite know what I do. Hold on a minute. I'll try and open my coat and see if that'll protect it. Not that there's a great deal more to tell you, because unless I keep you here all night, and it's still blazing all over the whole framework, but I don't know that it's much good keeping you up to hear about that. I think the only thing to say is that so far as I know, and I haven't bothered the experts, because it seems to me on occasion of this sort... Hello, here is an expert.
Not at all an expert, but I've just come round from behind the other side of the building, right in the garden, and the wind is blowing huge clouds of great acrid smoke right across, and sparks that are travelling a matter of 200 yards, and there's glass all over the grass, and those strange, shrouded females that inhabit the parks are... being peppered with flying sparks and flying glass.
Well, I don't know that there's any much more to say. I'm told that the first part of the broadcast is probably missed. I might as well explain to you that this was just picked up at very short notice, but on the top of a roof on the west terrace of the Crystal Palace. So, there's something more to be said.
Just let me tell you one more story, and that is of the south gallery. The flames are moving at the rate of about a yard in every 5 minutes, and the roof is coming crashing down in sections. The floor is getting under and beginning to eat up under the fireman's boots.
Well, I don't think we can keep you here any longer. I suppose this will go on blowing through the night. There'll be policemen here on duty all night. There'll be the farmmen working. And so we'll now leave the Crystal Palace and go back to Broadcasting House.
increased during the present year the numbers of the Territorial Army. We are about 40,000 short. We must somehow collect those men if the Territorial Army is to play in our national defense scheme the great part that has been assigned to it. I'm not sure that people quite realize how vitally important to us the Territorials are. We rely upon them in the first place for the defense of our coast. If any foreign invaders attempted to land upon our soil, it would be for the Territorial Army in the first instance to repel them.
And the line breaks at the first shock as the claymores lash and hack into the huddling ranks of men who stagger and fall back. And the surging clansmen flash their way amid the tangling mass to slay with a terrible grin whoever stand wedged in the path of a red right hand. And the horse are trampling back on the guns as the shouting riders rein and wheel about in screaming fear to scatter away in a mad career or stumble amid the slain. And bayonets are brushed aside like twigs or fall from a nerveless grip as men jerk back with heads laid open down to the dribbling lip. And the struggling mass gives way at last as the redcoats break in flight, and Sir John Cope is riding away from the stink of his own fright. For the battle is over in 7 minutes of men called Crest and Pans, where English soldiers ran like rabbits before the wrath of the clans.
Drama. Among original radio plays, T.G. Bryson's March of the 45 stands out as the most distinguished radio piece of the year. Here, probably for the first time, radio drama and art definitely met. Both from the poetic and the broadcasting point of view, the level of this play was remarkably high. Apart from this, the year was not particularly fertile in plays, especially written for broadcasting. However, there were three fine examples of plays in verse. Professor Gilbert Murray's translation of the Hippolytus of Euripides, Clemens Dane's translation of Rostand's L'Aiglon, and Mr. T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral.
Does it seem strange to you that the angels should have announced peace when ceaselessly the world has been stricken with war and the fear of war? Does it seem to you that the angelic voices were mistaken and that the promise was a disappointment and a cheat? Reflect now how our Lord himself spoke of peace. Did he mean peace as we think of it? The kingdom of England at peace with its neighbors? A king at peace with the barons? The householder counting over his peaceful gains? The swept hearth? His best wine for a friend on the table? His wife singing to the children? Those men, his disciples, knew no such things. They went forth to journey afar, to suffer by land and sea, to know torture, imprisonment, disappointment, to suffer death by martyrdom. What then did he mean? If you ask that, remember also that he said, "Not as the world gives, give I unto you." So then, he gave peace to his disciples, but not as the world gives.
Radio Gazette, a recorded review of events at home and abroad.
Will you excuse your observer from Geneva tonight for some hesitations or stumblings? But today has been a long day of much negotiation. And moreover, in the council chamber from which I've just run to the studio, there has just been a most unfortunate incident, an incident in which the president of the Senate of Danzig, after a fascinated speech as he was going out and after saluting with the Nazi salute, Mr. Eden, which caused some slight laughter in certain quarters of the press, made a very rude gesture indeed at the international press, an incident of which Mr. Eden, presiding over the council, found it in him to say, "We did not see any incident, and if there was one, it would be more in keeping with our dignity if we did not notice it." This is an incident with which the corridors of the League of Nations are even now buzzing.
News at home, London. A bus strike and a gas tariff war, a dog show and trouble in the East End.
Letter to Radio Times, March 13, 1936. The BBC is encouraging gambling in its most blatant form. On every occasion that a symphony concert is relayed, especially if Sir Thomas Beecham conducts, sweepstakes are organised on the number of minutes the said concert's overrun. For example, if after the end of the concert the announcement is made thus, "We regret the news being 22 minutes late," the person who has drawn number 22 wins money. In view of this terrible state of affairs, I would suggest that the Radio Times cease from publishing the dates and times of these concerts and instead simply state surprise item. Or else cut out symphony concerts altogether, they cannot run the line, as substitute a variety program, which can always be cut off.
But I always judge my audience by their applause and by the way they applaud. For instance, I always know when my bow is in the audience. He always applauds like this. That'll be a better gag when television comes in.
The match between Captain Orient and Crystal Palace was postponed owing to fog. Scottish League, Division 1, Celtic 4, Kilmarnock 0.
And now, what about this young man in the next net here?
Hello there. Come here for a minute.
I wondered if you'd like to broadcast for me. What's your name?
Andrew, sir.
Andrew, and a very good name, too. Now, let's see. What do you think about this schoolboy coaching at Lord's?
I think it's a grand idea, Uncle Mac. May I call you Uncle Mac?
Well, yes. As long as you listen to Children's Hour sometimes.
The plumbers have arrived.
Plumbers? Plumbers? What do they want?
You ordered me to fetch your plumber to look at your bath. You said it was leaking, so I sent round to Brass and Co. Families waited on daily.
The secretary went to the door and beckoned, and into the room stepped Peter Brass, carrying a bag of rattling tools, followed by Larry the Lamb with a pail of hot coals, which he placed on the carpet.
And what's that lamb doing here?
Please, Mr. Mayor, sir, I'm a plumber's mate. I decided to learn to be a plumber. You see, our little consciences have been worrying us. We thought it was not right for us to be doing nothing. It seems so lazy, lazy bones, so we decided to do some work.
A very proper spirit, very praiseworthy.
Friend said to me, "Hilton, what's your social and political philosophy?" "Oh, well," I said, all I can lay claim to is that I have my own particular way of looking at such things. I believe in Tom, Dick, and Harry. Of course, I know how important to the scheme of things are Sir Thomas, Lord Richard, and the Right Honorable Henry. But if they start throwing their weight about too much and I have to take sides, why, I side with Tom, Dick, and Harry. Now, you see what I mean, don't you? I believe in what is called the common people.
This is the regional program from the north. We're presenting Harry Hopeful's Day in the Dales, a Derbyshire itinerary initiated by G.G. Brightson and E.A. Harding.
Is Oakville, do you?
Me, Harry, lad, and now, huh?
Oh, I'm jumping. I'm as well as they make them, lad. Well, come here, Bill. Business, boss. You said you'd tell me how to make those ponds I kept coming across. You do make them, don't you?
I'm on with you, Macari.
Well, look here, what do you make them for at all?
Well, to say, we've been such a high-lying district up there, it's all limestone, you know, and as soon as ever it rains, water comes on, it runs away.
I see. You get droughted up, it's come alike.
But we have a storage tank, you know, and we're pumping water up from river.
What?
A storage tank against public.
And does that mean to tell me that they pump 600 feet of water and puts it in the tank against public house? It's daft.
This is London. A quarter of an hour ago, the Prime Minister came to the bar of the House and handed to the Speaker a message from His Majesty the King. Here is the text of the message, which was read by the Speaker. After long and anxious consideration, I have determined to renounce the throne, and I am now communicating this, my final and irrevocable decision.
I now quit altogether public affairs, and I lay down my burden. It may be some time before I return to my native land, but I shall always follow the fortunes of the British race and empire with profound interest.
Sunday of the year, an old year is going, and a new year is coming. We stand at a parting of the ways, a stage in the journey of personal and national life, when we do well to stop and think, to ask, whither are we moving?
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Cosmo Gordon Lang.
All of you, and especially any to whom some measure of wealth or position brings the responsibility of influence and example, I ask to think seriously whither present tendencies of moral conduct are carrying our national life. Pleasures you must have. God knows how needful they are as means of escape from the strain of life or the monotony of work. See that they are wholesome, that the wine leaves no bitter dregs.
Now the entire dancing floor is formed up in line, all jogging up and down, all these vari-colored headdresses and costumes. It's marvelous. The things are working up now to a fever pitch, because it's getting very, very close to midnight. Soon those six great baskets of balloons up in the roof there will be released, and the chimes of Big Ben will declare that 1936 is over. So may we wish you a very, very happy new year in 1937. And whatever you may have thought of the old year, I hope the last 15 minutes of it haven't been too bad. A happy new year!